Exchange Working Group will come to order. One of the things on our agenda today is to talk about the option for a basic health plan within an exchange structure, and we have with us today Judith Solomon, who is the co-director of health policy for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Start?
Go ahead.
You can see this. So I had actually two topics today. First of all, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. And just for those of you who don't know the Center on Budget, we work at the federal and state levels on fiscal policy and public programs, particularly those that affect low and moderate income people. So my slides that I think you have a copy of cover two topics. And we're going to start actually on the ninth slide, which is where the basic health plan starts. And people should have copies. I guess they're not going up on the
other ones.
The basic health option is a state option that is in the Affordable Care Act. For those of you who want to see where it is, it's in Section 1331 of the Act. And what it is an alternative coverage option for people with incomes above the Medicaid income level. Under health reform, as you all probably know, there's a major Medicaid expansion that will cover people. The law says under 133% of the poverty line, but it actually is 138 because there's a little bump up in how the income rules work. And those with incomes between 138 and 200. So instead of people receiving premium credits to purchase qualified health plans in the exchange, basic health is an option where the state would actually take over providing coverage for that group using federal funds. So the federal funds that would otherwise go, 95% of the federal funds that would otherwise go for coverage of that group would then be used by the state to design coverage options through contracting with health plans using competitive bidding to cover people. If the state takes basic health, that's the option for this group. They don't have the alternative of going and getting premium credits. Where this came from was that Senator Maria Cantwell, a member of the Finance Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, was aware of the basic health program in Washington State that was used state-only dollars to provide coverage. And she believed that states could actually do a better job of using those funds to get coverage that was more comprehensive and affordable than what would be in the exchange. So basically, there's flexibility for the states as long as they provide at least the same coverage that people would get in the exchange to provide different benefits. And in fact, there's an expectation that, written right in the law, that states would have coverage with innovative features like care coordination, chronic disease management, preventive services, and additional other benefits. So as I said, what this does is really give the state the pot of federal dollars. This is not Medicaid where you have a match requirement. While the state would run it, the financing is totally federal. The state has to establish a trust fund for these federal dollars, and to the extent the coverage that it designs costs less and there's money left over, it has to really be reinvested in the program. So it's not something where, you know, you could use savings for other purposes. It's federal dollars to be used for this purposes, but there's no state share. We, if you do just really a back of the envelope analysis, which is really hard, all you can really do now because we don't have solid information on exactly what the subsidies are going to be, but there are some Congressional Budget Office estimates of what the expected level of federal subsidies are for both the premiums and cost sharing. There's separate subsidies for premiums and cost sharing for people in this income group. And you look at that relative to what states spend now in their Medicaid program on adults. You see that even without factoring in any premiums paid by the individual, and the expectation is certainly in the exchange that people in this income group would be contributing towards the cost of coverage, but without even factoring that in, you see that the coverage, costs of coverage are going to be less than what the subsidies are. Now, I think most states would want to, taking up this option, would probably want to ramp up provider payments above what Medicaid covers. So it's not an apples-to-apples comparison to say it's going to cost the same as Medicaid. But certainly, at least on the benefits that are provided, the Medicaid benefit package is probably more comprehensive than what's in the exchange. And the Medicaid population that you're covering now is probably, on the whole, a little more expensive. So it's pretty clear, I think, that what you would get in federal dollars to negotiate with health plans and provide coverage would be enough to provide a more comprehensive benefit package with lower cost sharing than adults would get in the exchange. And in a state like Minnesota, I think that's, definitely something we're thinking about, because you are covering, parents now at these higher income levels, and it's likely when they move into the exchange, their cost of coverage would go up significantly from what they're paying now. So I think that's, one reason I think, states like Minnesota and Maine and Connecticut are really looking at this option. The other potential advantages, I think a very large advantage is better coordination of coverage. In every state in 2014, what we will see is that we will have everybody in Medicaid under this 138 families together. But once you cross that line over 138, I think every state will then be in the situation where parents go into the premium credit, purchase qualified health plan through the exchange, but kids stay in CHIP. And so that's a couple things, having different plans to negotiate. But you also, in many states, have the situation of you're paying premiums to the exchange, and many states charge premiums for CHIP. So you're paying, for two coverages with different rules around renewal periods, and you have this lack of family coordination. And then I think the other way that basic health provides opportunities for coordination is that you can use maybe the same health plans you use in your Medicaid program. And I think most states thinking about it are thinking that they would do that for coordination, and also leverages their purchasing power, because you now have a much larger pool to purchase coverage on behalf of more people. So even on the Medicaid side, you can't use basic health to pay for Medicaid, but there's benefits to having that larger pool that can redound not only to basic health but also to Medicaid. And then, as I said, for the individual beneficiaries, the possibility of more affordable and comprehensive coverage. There are some potential disadvantages that I think we need to really think about. I was up in Maine talking to a legislative working group very similar to this, and I think this was a much bigger problem for them than it was in Minnesota, because it's a small state with a lower population. If you pull the people under 200 out, and then you leave the people above 200 in the exchange, you just don't know if you're going to have that critical mass of people to create a robust risk pool in the exchange. I think you have a larger population here. It may be less of a concern, but it's definitely something that needs to be examined. You know, there's things that could be done to mitigate, again, by, you know, having plans participate in all the options. That also will help the coordination as people cross the 200% of poverty line, because at some point people move into the premium credits regardless. And then I think the other part of it is you could do this, a state, you know, might do this in a way that further fragments coverage. So you have, you know, really the four-layer cake of Medicaid, basic health, premium credits, CHIP, without really thinking through how that coordinates and have a lot of gaps in coverage and disruptions. At the Center on Budget, we actually just received a grant under a special coverage initiative of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to work on basic health, and we're going to be doing a couple things. One is working with federal policymakers on the guidance and regulations. There are you know, there are unanswered questions exactly what that methodology is going to be to figure out what 95% is. I mean, what is the population? You don't really have a history yet. The law talks about using maybe a neighboring state, since exchange, so if another state isn't doing this, you could look at what their premiums are. But nobody's going to have that in the first instance. So figuring out prospectively what those premiums are, what are the consumer protections, what are really the expectations regarding innovation. The law says there are some, but exactly what there are, what the rules are on quality reporting. Those are the kinds of things at the federal level that are not answered. And then the other part of this, and I think the bulk of the work that we're going to be doing, is working with states, helping them think through what these options are. So I think in the first instance for a state is really to kind of look at your programs in place now, think through, you know, who your health plans are and what this would really mean. I do think it is, particularly in a state that has a history of covering people at higher income levels, very different from states, you know, that I've been in where there's no coverage at all. There's no history of covering adults without children, and even parents are covered at, you know, really very low percentage of poverty. It's a very different environment here where you have this history, you have something to build on. The ability to design your own coverage option, I think, presents some attractions for a group that you have been engaged in over the years. So that was all I had on basic health, if people have questions.
Are there questions? I have one question, Ms. Solomon. Since all of the groups have their eligibility determined through an exchange, this group would also then have their eligibility determined through an exchange. And so for them, wouldn't it be fairly seamless? I mean, they pull up what their plan options were and what their coverage was, and they would sign up through that mechanism. And really, it's just the mechanisms for financing in the back room that are different here. So I don't understand how it would decrease the size of the pool. It's just this part of the pool is purchasing a little bit differently than the other part of the pool, but they're all purchasing from private insurance companies through the pool.
Right, but it may be different plans. I mean, I think that's some of what you'd have to think through. I mean, it could be, you know, if it could be Medicaid plans that are not participating in the exchange, it's just really hard to know. I think it is possible to mitigate it. I mean, the other thing that I think on the coordination issue is, you know, people change a lot. You know, people's incomes change. I think the federal policymakers are grappling with that now as they think about kind of the general notion of using past income to predict future income and realizing that that is going to be very difficult because people's income changes. So the ability to kind of maintain stability as income changes. And then the other thing that I didn't mention that I think is worth mentioning is that the premium credits are tax credits. And basic health would be a much more of a true subsidy. There's real difficult challenges that people are going to confront with these premium credits in terms of, you know, how sensitive are they to the people's actual needs based on their income, particularly if it changes. And then there's a reconciliation process at the end where, you know, you can end up having to pay back money. So I think that's going to be something that, at least for the lower income people, you could avoid that through the basic health program.
Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Solomon, just following up on Senator Berglund's question, I guess, is what you're saying is that from, I'm not sure if I'm going to use the right terminology, but from looking at one pool's experience from one year to the next and determining what the cost would be going forward, kind of looking at the experience rating, that these two groups would be considered separate and that's why it might change, the size of the pool might change, the question of adverse selection might come into play?
Right, because the premium credits in what would then be 200 to 400, and then, of course, people that don't get credits at all participating in the exchange qualified health plans, those plans could actually look different than what you would have in basic health, probably would. I think, you know, the basic health plans, and so if you can't figure out a way to sort of pool the risk across these products, and you may not be able to if you have different plans participating, you know, do you have enough people in that other group, considering you also have an outside market? It was definitely something in Maine. They were just afraid they wouldn't have a viable exchange, basically, because their population is so small, and their population is pretty low income. So when you pull out those people, you know, who's left to be in your exchange, and particularly because you want the exchange to be there for people who don't get a subsidy at all, you want it to be a place people can go get coverage. So that's essentially it.
Other questions? Okay, why don't you move on then?
Okay, I'll go backwards now. Okay, so I think you all have a copy of a paper that my colleague Sarah Leek wrote on adverse selection, and much of what I have here is in the paper and in greater detail. I'm gonna do a disclaimer. I know this material fairly well, but I am not the expert at the center on this. I do my area at the center is much more on the Medicaid, basic health, the premium coverage, eligibility, and enrollment. So I can say that it's very likely you're going to stump me, but if you do, I'll get the answers and get them back to you. So I think, this was a term that I actually didn't even, you always hear it, and a lot of people have learned really well what it is. So it's very simply adverse selection is where less healthy people and healthy people separate into different insurance arrangements. And because one pool has the less healthy people, it costs more, it spends more on health care, and over time it has to keep charging more. The more it has to charge, the more people it loses. And then you get these death spirals and failure. And this is not theoretical. This is real. It's happened. PAC Advantage small business pool in California. There was a plan in the Federal Employees Benefit Health Plan that failed in this way. It was selected more by less healthy people. So we know this can happen. There's really two things I'm going to talk about. There's adverse selection in the new sort of health reform design. There can be adverse selection into the exchange. So that's what I'm going to talk about first. So the less healthy people get their coverage through the exchange, and healthier people go outside into the existing individual and small group market, which I think most states are going to maintain their markets outside. So there's that. And then there's adverse selection inside the exchange, which we'll spend less time on, where less healthy people choose a particular health plan, and that can put stress on that particular product in the exchange. The biggest risk with the outside market is the fact that you can have different rules inside and outside the exchange. That the biggest one is that inside the exchange, all plans will have, beginning in 2014, all health plans are going to have to meet these coverage tiers, defined tiers of coverage. They call them the heavy metal tiers, bronze, silver, gold, platinum, in that order. And what those are plans with different actuarial values, starting at 60 and going up to 90. Actuarial value is the percentage of covered services that the health plan pays for a typical population, not for an individual necessarily, but across a typical population. So a bronze plan covers 60%. Now, that's likely to be a plan with a pretty high deductible. People will not really receive the insurance coverage until they meet a pretty high deductible. In the exchange, if a health insurer wants to offer coverage inside the exchange, it has to at least offer plans at the silver and gold tier. Then it can offer a bronze and a platinum plan, but only if it offers the silver and gold. In the outside market, you still have to have the tiers, but a plan could decide just to offer a bronze plan. And a plan could just offer coverage in the outside market. A bronze plan is likely to attract healthier people. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to have a high deductible. Maybe it'll cover first dollar preventive services. But, you know, we've seen those plans. We know what they look like. You know, I had my kids enrolled in them when they didn't have any other coverage options. It's going to attract, and then there's some other things, other rules around provider network adequacy, marketing requirements, contracting with essential community health providers like community health centers, reporting requirements that only really have to apply within the exchange. And so if they don't apply outside the exchange, you might see some differences in price and attractions to healthy and less healthy people. Now, the Affordable Care Act does include a number of really, really important features that should help protect against the risk of adverse selection. And the very first one, and probably the biggest one, is the fact that the premium credits and the credits that small business will be able to get to offer coverage are only available for coverage in the exchange. So whether you're healthy or not healthy, if you're eligible for and want a premium credit, you're going to have to go in the exchange. So that's really number one. As I also noted, the tiers, the market reforms that will take place, such as being required to sell to everyone regardless of health status, the community rating rules, all will apply across both markets. And then there's two others that have been sort of, you know, touted as really eliminating the risk that I just want to say a little bit more about. And one is risk adjustment. Risk adjustment would be if your health plan is attracting less healthy people, you would get some of my money. And mine was healthy, you would get some of my money. But the idea has not really been worked out in a way that really has worked well. For the most part, to the extent it's compensated at all for the risk, it's been incomplete and only for sort of part of it. It's really hard to predict. You need really, really good data. In the Medicare Advantage program, there's been what's called upcoding, where plans sort of say they're covering sicker people than they really are. It's a really hard thing to do well. And then the idea that you would pool risk across plans inside and outside the exchange, and therefore the price would be based on everybody in all the various products, also could help a little bit. But as I said, the problem is that there's no requirement that you sell inside and outside, and no requirement that you offer the same products inside and outside. So that is probably going to have limited effect. So what can states do? Well, there's four things that are covered in the paper that we talked about. And the first is really to apply those same rules. So to the extent you have quality reporting standards, marketing rules, provider network adequacy rules, you would apply those both inside and outside. Now, one important thing is thinking about how you're going to finance the exchange over time. There are federal funds available through 2014, but after that, in 2015, the operation of the exchange is supposed to be self-supporting. And the way that this likely will be done, the way it's done in Massachusetts, is through assessments on insurers. If you only, and the understanding is those assessments would be passed through in the cost of premiums. So you might want to think about having assessments on the outside market as well, so you don't drive up costs in the exchange relative to the outside. The same thing goes for things like broker commissions, thinking about how much they are inside and outside, so you don't drive up the costs inside relative to the outside. The second thing is requiring that insurers offer the same products inside and outside. Now, there's a problem with this. If you are going to have an exchange on the sort of active purchaser model, which I think we feel at the center positive about, which is the exchange actually is selective in terms of plans that operate in the exchange and looking for price and quality. If you're going to do that, then you really can't require them inside and outside to be the same. So there are some sort of alternatives to that, which could be to say that a plan can't just offer a bronze plan outside. So even though you're not offering the same plans inside and outside, you have the same tiers available, and that you don't have that sort of advantage of just providing a bronze plan outside. I think most states are likely to have separate exchanges for individuals and small groups, and that probably makes sense in the first instance. But over time, if you can merge those markets, you really have to let your rating rules take hold so you don't have any kind of rate shock that could occur if you merge them right away. But over time, if you can merge those, you have a larger pool inside the exchange, and that in itself is a protection of adverse selection. And then finally, I didn't mean to say that risk adjustment and pooling are not important. They are, and that what you really want to do is make them work as best as they can. What we're really saying is they're not the entire answer. And what that really entails is really monitoring the data, enforcing data requirements, making sure that nobody's sort of gaming by things like upcoding. So just very briefly on adverse selection within the exchange, this could happen between the tiers, the healthy people going in the bronze plans. It could happen in general. Healthier people are more likely to pick an HSA. Less healthy people are more likely to pick a PPO, a preferred provider organization, or an HMO. So it could happen there in terms of the types of products. And then it can happen through benefit design. I think that is probably the biggest place where adverse selection can be can happen. So if to the extent, and we don't know what the essential benefits are in the plans yet, so we don't know how much leeway there's going to be in terms of what plans offer. But, for example, you could see where you set up a formulary that isn't really welcoming to people with chronic disease or people with cancer. That kind of benefit design can serve to attract lower risk. So to deal with that, a state could limit the variation in the benefits across the tiers and between the tiers, and try to rely more on cost-sharing differences. So that if you had a silver plan and a bronze plan, for example, that the benefit package would be relatively the same, except that the bronze plan would have higher cost-sharing, and that's the way you would get to 60%, between a gold and a bronze, that your differences would be in things like deductibles. That makes it far easier for consumers as well. It's interesting, in Massachusetts, they've actually moved in that direction, because what they found when they went back in focus groups after their first couple years of operation was that consumers felt like there were too many choices. Choice is good, but too much choice can be overwhelming to people, and that, is something that they've now gone and done, is limit the number of products. Because, it's not enough to say you have tiers. A silver plan can look very different. Silver plans can be very different from each other, depending on the design of the benefit package, both as to the cost sharing and as to the benefits. And if you do it based on cost sharing, I think it's a lot easier for people to make an informed choice. And then I think just the monitoring and enforcing of marketing policies, looking for things that are, designed to draw healthier people, making sure that kind of market behavior is addressed and doesn't happen is the last thing. And that's basic health plan. So that was adverse selection, and to the extent I'm able, I can try to answer your questions.
Are there any questions? I guess I have one question, and that is, if we are providing the same benefit set for people above 200% of poverty, up to 400% of poverty, and the benefits are not in the essential benefit set that the federal government outlines, then my understanding is we as a state have to pay for that benefit. And so we may not want or may not be able to afford to pay for a benefit for people between 200 and 400, but we may feel that it would be advantageous to our health policy goals to do that for people between 138 and 200.
Yeah, and you could do that through basic health. What I think you're referring to are the state mandates, and what happens to state mandated benefits, and every state has an array of state mandated benefits. The rule is that if a state wants to maintain a mandated benefit that is not in the essential benefits package, and again, we don't know what's going to be in that package.
Well, we do know adult dental won't be in it.
Correct.
And, you know, for us, adult dental has been an important part mm-hmm. of our Minnesota Care program to help make sure that people with chronic diseases are,
right.
you know, taking
right.
care of their oral
right.
health.
Right, and it's pretty confusing because what it says is the state, so it wouldn't be like, they'd have to figure out some valuation for that to be included in the qualified health plans, and then you would have to pay for that, the state, not the individual. So it's
right.
It's pretty.
So, and I'm not sure how much, you know, having a benefit like that in or out is going to change your actuarial assumptions.
Right. This is
with Minnesota Care. We've had no underwriting. It's people self-select to get in. The limitation is income only and paying of some cost sharing. And we never worried about adverse selection. Our assumption was most of these people aren't going to be insured if they don't have this. So, you know.
Yeah, I think the adverse selection comes in much more as you move up the income scale. I think that's right.
And as you move up the income scale, you tend to have healthier people anyway. So,
exactly.
You know,
right.
If it's worth getting ourselves all excited about it or not. Are there other questions? Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair. The question I have, or just clarification, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, I think for Minnesota, is where we have to pay attention to adverse selection because that's where there's about $150 million of losses on about 27,000 members. As those redistribute into the market over time, that's really will be the key where, to me, adverse selection could come into play and could harm the market. So that I think is really the key. While you don't need to worry about it in some of the public programs, you do in the fully insured market where people will have a choice to insure or not.
No, I think that's right.
Well, I think you need to worry about that all of those people aren't ending up in one health plan. But we need to remember that we do pay, our insurance companies pay for enrollment in MSHA. So it is part of the cost of doing business today. It's not like it's a brand new cost that we never had. How that cost gets distributed among various insurance companies, I think, is something to worry about. But having a new cost, I don't see it as a new cost, I guess is my way of looking at it.
It's how it gets distributed.
Right. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you talk a little bit more about going back to the basic health plan, a little bit more about how a basic health plan might be structured so it could actually basically, so someone in the basic health plan would be in the same pool as someone in exchange? Because I'm thinking about this as people might tend to have a higher risk profile the lower their income is concerned. It seems to me that if we take those people out of the pool, we've created a higher risk pool that's receiving only 95% of what everyone else is receiving.
Yeah, and the law addresses that. I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, is that in determining the 95%, it is keyed to that group, the 138 to 200, recognizing that that group may be more expensive. They're already going to be getting higher subsidies because they're going to be getting additional subsidies for cost sharing to fill in cost sharing in addition to premium subsidies. But I think the law is pretty clear that there's an understanding that you don't look at the 200 to 400 and take 95 of that. You figure out, and that's why I was saying it's sort of hard to figure out how are they going to do it, but it's based on that population, which may be less healthy overall than your 200 to 400. So I think the states are actually protected on that issue. Did I understand? Was that your question?
Thank you. Yeah.
Other questions? That's not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
April Todd Mamlow is going to talk to us a little bit about financing options for state exchanges.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is April Todd Momlev. I'm the state health economist and director of the Health Economics Program. And my presentation today is going to cover exchange financing options that are allowed under the law. Just as some background, before we start talking about different types of financing mechanisms for the exchange, just wanted to remind the group about the provisions in the law related to startup funding, ongoing funding, and some new information that we have just learned from HHS regarding Medicaid systems funding. So related to startup funding, HHS is to award states for the establishment of exchanges. The funding level in the law is not specified, but according to the CBO, there are estimates that the total for all states would be about $2 billion. This is just for startup funding, and this funding is available until the end of 2015. And this funding can only be used for startup expenses. It cannot be used for ongoing operations. For ongoing funding, the exchange must become self-sustaining by January 1st of 2015. And in the law, there is broad flexibility on how the exchange can be funded for its ongoing operations. It can establish assessments, user fees, or other types of financing mechanisms. Now, separate from the exchange, but somewhat related given the exchange's function of doing Medicaid eligibility and enrollment, we've recently learned from HHS that Medicaid systems will be eligible for a 90% matching rate, which they previously had not been eligible for. So up until 2015, states will be eligible for a 90% matching rate for creating enhanced or new Medicaid eligibility systems, and there will be a 75% match for the maintenance of these systems after 2015. In order to get this matching rate, the Medicaid system must be interoperable with the exchange. Now, this funding is different from the startup funding for exchange IT. So the exchange information technology that would be used to, for example, determine subsidies, show product choices, that type of thing would be funded through exchange startup funding. But the Medicaid eligibility systems that would allow for changes or to upgrade eligibility systems to allow them to interact with the exchange, those would be eligible for this state matching rate funding. The rest of the presentation is going to focus on the possibilities for ongoing exchange funding sources. These next two tables are a way to show the different markets that would be served by different functions that the exchange is either required to do or could optionally do. So this slide in particular refers to those required exchange functions and lays out where you'll see the X's are the types of populations or the markets that those functions would serve. So there are some functions that specifically would just serve the exchange enrollees, others that would serve Medicaid enrollees that may determine their eligibility through the exchange, some other things, for example, providing comparative insurer ratings, determining coverage exemptions for the mandate, communicating information on subsidy eligibility for employers, those types of things would have a broader market impact or would be a service that would be provided to the fully insured market, the general population as a whole, and some things that would also apply to insurers, providers, and navigators. The next slide is similar to the one prior, but outlines some of the optional functions that we have discussed in this group before related to what the exchange could do and how those things could also be impacting a broader population. I'm not going to go through all of these, but just as an example, last time we had talked about risk adjustment, or the last time that I was here, we had talked about risk adjustment. And risk adjustment, since, for example, it would need to be conducted for plans inside and outside the exchange, would benefit private market enrollees, the fully insured market, not just those in the exchange, and insurers in general inside and outside the exchange. And potentially, depending on how risk adjustment is done, could also have some interaction potentially with the Medicaid system as well. So now on to some of the financing options. And these are some general categories of financing options. It doesn't cover the full breadth of what could be considered in terms of financing options, but wanted to give you some broad categories to think about. The first is a user fee. And this would essentially be an assessment on products sold through the exchange that would be charged to enrollees. So essentially an add-on to the premium that would be charged to enrollees. This would assess consumers of the exchange with the cost of running the exchange, so they're paying for the service that they're getting through the exchange. The issue here is that it does not take into account that some of the services of the exchange provide benefits to consumers that do not use the exchange and provide some benefits to stakeholders as well, such as insurers, providers, and navigators or brokers. Lastly, this would also likely discourage exchange enrollment, especially for those not eligible for subsidies and for small employers, because it would make the cost of products in the exchange more expensive than those that are outside of the exchange. Another option to fund the ongoing operations of the exchange is to collect a portion of the premium. So the exchange would keep a percent or a flat fee of the total product premium that is charged through the exchange. This would allow premiums inside and outside the exchange to be the same and thus not discourage exchange participation. It acknowledges some, but not all of the benefits an exchange may provide to consumers and stakeholders. And one thing to consider here is how this option impacts the medical loss ratio. So the administrative costs of health insurance plans are now going to be under a new medical loss ratio calculation. If the exchange kept a portion of that premium, that portion that went to the exchange would also likely still be counted in the insurer's medical loss ratio. Now, related to functions that the exchange would be doing in lieu of a health plan, such as paying navigators or brokers, that's something that could make some sense. For if you were going to use a portion of the premium to pay for the entire operation of the exchange, there could be issues here where part of the assessment that you would have as a portion of that premium would not be related to other functions that insurers would do in lieu of the exchange, and so you may be actually adding to an insurer's medical loss ratio. Another option to consider is a fully insured market fee, so an assessment on fully insured products sold by insurers. Could be something similar, for example, to the MSHA assessment or the insurer premium tax. Could be a percentage of the premium or some type of flat fee per policy or per enrollee. Again, this would allow premiums inside and outside the exchange to be the same. It would assess consumers with fully insured products purchased outside the exchange with some costs of the exchange that don't benefit them. So if you use this as your sole mechanism, those people that are getting coverage outside the exchange would be paying for something that they don't see a benefit from. It would acknowledge that some services that consumers not purchasing in the exchange and would be accounted for, but those consumers, such as self-funded plans or other stakeholders, this still wouldn't account for some of the benefits that they would get through the exchange. And again, here there's another consideration to consider regarding the medical loss ratio. If there is some type of a tax or a fee that is placed on insurers, for example, that tax could likely be excluded from the medical loss ratio calculation. Under the new rules and regulations, those assessments or taxes are excluded from that calculation. This could likely be excluded from that as well. That's an issue here because if some of that funding was used, for example, to pay for brokers or some of those other services that the exchange is doing in lieu of the plans doing it, it would exclude that from that plan's medical loss ratio calculation. So essentially making their medical loss ratio look a little bit lower than it otherwise would have. Another financing option to consider is a broad-based market fee. This could be an assessment similar to the provider tax or some type of general fund appropriation that would apply broadly to the population. A benefit here is, again, it would allow premiums inside and outside the exchange to be the same. It would assess some consumers with the cost of the exchange that they don't see the benefit from, but it would acknowledge that there is a broad base of consumers and stakeholders that do benefit from some of the services that the exchange would perform. One concern here is that anything tied to some type of legislative appropriation could make the funding of the exchange more political under this type of funding mechanism. Another option to consider is the Medicaid match. And generally, under federal Medicaid matching funds, the federal government matches roughly 50% of the activities necessary for the administration of the Medicaid program. Currently, outreach activities, eligibility determination, and managed care enrollment are generally accepted types of Medicaid administrative activities, and those are also the types of activities that the exchange would be performing for this population as well. So it's likely that the Medicaid administrative match could be used for these types of services. However, there are some exchange activities that do not meet the definition of necessary for Medicaid administration because they tend to serve a larger purpose than Medicaid. So these types of services, for example, providing comparative information on all health insurance products, those types of things, even if Medicaid plans were included in the exchange with comparison information, that type of service that is provided more broadly to the population may not be eligible to be matched with that funding. A few other things to keep in mind regarding the Medicaid match is that the non-federal share may only include public funds that are appropriated or transferred to the Medicaid agency or certified by a local unit of government as a Medicaid expenditure. So private spending is not directly matchable by Medicaid. Another thing to keep in mind is that counties, given that some of those functions regarding Medicaid, regarding eligibility and enrollment are currently done by the counties. So if the structure changes, those counties may lose or get less federal matching funds if county residents use the exchange for Medicaid eligibility. So there's a need here to think through generally what the future role of counties will be related to Medicaid. And related to that, it's unclear if this change related to how counties are included in the Medicaid match, it's unclear how the non-federal share would need to be paid, if it's something that would need to come out solely of state funds, or whether some of the other exchange financing mechanisms could be considered the state share. For example, if part of the exchange was paid for by the provider tax, which is a public type of tax, that's a mechanism that could likely be used as the non-federal share for Medicaid. Some other options to consider, and these are more kind of out-of-the-box types of types of financing mechanisms for the exchange, is to raise revenue through things such as naming rights or advertising through the exchange or grants, that type of thing. This could reduce or eliminate the need for fees or assessments on consumers and stakeholders, but the funding may not be predictable or stable. The exchange would need to compete to show value to attract this type of funding, but it could potentially harm the independent nature of the exchange to take these types of funding mechanisms. So those are generally the six broad categories that you could think through for potential funding options for the exchange. Related to that, I just wanted to give some examples of related to what states that either have an exchange or have passed exchange legislation are doing for their ongoing funding for the exchange. Massachusetts, the connector collects a portion of the premium. It's roughly 3-4% to fund its ongoing operations, and the budget of that exchange is roughly $30 or so million a year. Utah funds their ongoing operations in a different manner. They're funded through a combination of a state appropriation and a variety of user fees, including broker fees and technology fees related to use of the exchange. And California, which recently passed their exchange legislation, also uses a combination of funding mechanisms. They use will use a portion of the premium and a participation fee on health plans. So just in summary, some key points to keep in mind. By 2015, the exchange must be self-sustaining, and startup funding that the exchange would get cannot be used for ongoing operations after 2015. So there has to be an ongoing funding source established. The law does allow for broad flexibility in the types of ongoing funding sources that can be used. If you look at the required and the optional functions that the exchange can perform, they can benefit a variety of different types of consumers and stakeholders, not just those that are using the exchange. So something to consider is potentially a combination of different types of funding sources that would be tied to the benefits that different populations get from the exchange. And that's the end. I'll open for questions.
Are there questions? Yes.
I have one. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Ms. Mameloff. On your like third or fourth slide in, you comment about some of the services of the exchange provide benefits to consumers that do not use the exchange. Could you just explain a little bit more what you mean by that?
Yep. So there are some services, and I'll just give a few examples here. If the exchange was to the exchange needs to provide comparative information on health plans and products and those types of things. If those products are the same inside and outside the exchange, that comparative information that the exchange is providing, just that source of information, could be of benefit both to consumers that purchase inside the exchange and to consumers that purchase outside the exchange as well. And especially the health plan ratings, that would be of use to a variety of different consumers in addition to those that use the exchange. Some other examples include the exchange needs to determine coverage requirement exemptions. So even if an individual is not going to be purchasing coverage through the exchange and the exchange makes that determination that they are exempt from the individual coverage requirement, that is helping those individuals as well, even though they aren't purchasing coverage through the exchange. And another example is the exchange also will be providing information to employers that do offer coverage or don't offer coverage, information about their subsidy-eligible employees. And this is provided to determine which employers are subject to the penalties for offering coverage or not offering coverage that is affordable for those individuals. So it also provides services to those employers as well by doing a function to determine if that penalty applies to those employers or not. So it does provide some services outside of the exchange as well. And then also related to that would be some of those optional functions, for example, related to risk adjustment, or if the exchange would be providing information on cost, quality, and enrollee satisfaction for providers in addition to health plans. That is a mechanism as well that could help individuals outside the exchange as well.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right, thank you very much. We have a presentation about potential governance structures by Mark Shepherd with House Research.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mark Shepherd from the House of Representatives Research Department. And in my work for House Research, I work primarily on issues relating to state government structure and operations. And the memo that I have that's in your packet today is intended to provide background that I hope will be useful to you when you're thinking about the structure of a health insurance exchange. And in general, if the exchange is created as an executive branch state agency, it would then be subject to a whole list of laws that apply to executive branch state agencies unless the law creating the exchange provides otherwise. On the other hand, if the law creating the exchange says this is a nonprofit corporation and it's not a state agency, then it wouldn't be subject to that whole list of laws unless the law creating the exchange said that it was subject to those laws. So the main point that I want to make today is that the legislature would have a tremendous amount of flexibility in specifying which of this long catalog of laws that apply to state agencies applies to this group. With a very few exceptions, the legislature could pick and choose among these and say that this is a state agency, but these laws that typically apply to state agencies don't apply to this group. Or it could say this is a nonprofit corporation, but some laws that apply to public entities do apply to this group. So what I've tried to do, I'm not going to walk through this whole long memo, but what I've tried to provide as a reference document for you is a summary of the laws that typically apply automatically to a group when it is created as an executive branch state agency, recognizing that the legislature could provide that some or all of these laws don't apply to the exchange. And these laws I've clustered into three different topics. The first is appointing the governing body. The second is the laws governing operations of executive branch state agencies. And the third is laws governing employees. And then at the end of the memo, I've tried to give you some examples of a bunch of different kinds of groups that are each unique in with respect to what laws apply to them. So with regard to appointing the governing boards of executive branch state agencies, in most cases, the laws that create these executive agencies provide that the governor or another person who's appointed by the governor appoints the members of these boards. And this practice is grounded somewhat in constitutional concerns because the Minnesota Constitution provides that for executive branch agencies, the governor may appoint officers provided by law. So if you do decide to create this as an executive branch state agency, there may be constraints on having somebody other than the governor appoint the members of the governing board. Having said that, in the memo I've provided an example of the Minnesota Zoo, which is specifically created by the law as a public-private partnership. And half of the members are appointed by the governor, and the other half are appointed by the zoo board itself, similar to the way that a private nonprofit corporation would typically work. I've also pointed to EMCHA, which you all are more familiar with than I am, as an example of a group which is treated more like a nonprofit organization than like a state agency, but has some members that are appointed by the Commissioner of Commerce, a governmental official. Other laws that would apply if this were a state agency, there's an open appointments law where there's a notice process administered by the Secretary of State's office where people who are interested in applying for open positions on government bodies get notice of vacancies. It's on the Secretary of State's website every month. The appointing authority is not limited to appointing only people that apply through that process, but there are specific notice requirements, and they do take some time, generally at least 45 days, to comply with that open appointments process. The Senate, the law often provides for the Senate to confirm members of public boards, which of course would not be the case if this were a nonprofit organization. And again, I've provided as an example the zoo, in which some of the members, the board appointees, are not subject to Senate confirmation. One of the concepts that is sometimes discussed when thinking about government agencies is the concept of making a government agency somewhat independent within state government. And often the way to do this as a practical matter is to provide terms that overlap a governor's terms so that the terms of members are staggered, and then to provide that members can be removed during a term only for cause, and cause would not include a disagreement with the political philosophy of the appointing authority. So there's numerous examples. Many of the health occupation regulating boards, for example, in which the membership terms overlap the governor's terms, and the members can be removed only for cause. One constitutional limit, if you do create something within state government as a governmental entity, then legislators generally can't serve as members of executive branch boards because the Minnesota Constitution prohibits legislators from holding other office. So if you're thinking you wanted any kind of legislative representation, that could be a constraint. I'm going to briefly go over some of the laws that govern executive agency operations. I think the two that would be the most significant for this group, regardless of whether it were created as a traditional executive branch state agency or as a nonprofit organization, are the Open Meeting Law and the Data Practices Act. The Open Meeting Law requires that multi-member state agencies conduct all their business publicly, whether they're making decisions or not. So anytime a quorum of members is present and to gather information or hear conduct public business of the entity, that meeting has to be advance notice, and it has to be open to the public. And in the age of modern technology, one interesting constraint that has come up is that this, at least on the local government level, has been interpreted to mean that you can't conduct email conversation in which a quorum of members hits respond, reply to all feature, and conducts business of the government entity that way. It's not clear, it's not written in the law, but sort of the conservative practice is you don't do that. And so in thinking about the structure of this board, you may want to consider not just the fact that a meeting has to be open, as many nonprofit board meetings are, but some of the other requirements of the open meeting law that might come along with that. The Data Practices Act is another important set of laws that applies to government agencies but not to private nonprofit groups, and it establishes a presumption that all government data is public, and then there's a list of exceptions to that. One of the exceptions that I pointed out in the memo, the legislature has provided that MCHA is subject to the Data Practices Act, even though it's not generally a state agency, but then it said that most MCHA data is private. So that, I think, illustrates my general point in that the legislature in creating this would have a lot of flexibility in determining how these laws apply, but I think it would be important to think through all of these so that you don't wind up with unintended consequences. On page 4 of the memo, I've outlined some ethical practices laws that apply to public officials, the gift ban law, laws governing conflicts of interest, and laws requiring disclosure of certain economic interests. I won't go into the details of those other than just to point out you could make one or more of these apply to a group created as a nonprofit corporation, and there are some examples of laws that do that. The Administrative Procedure Act is a process established in state law that agencies have to follow when they're making rules, which is defined very broadly to mean any agency statement of general applicability and future effect. So this would have a very big effect on the operation of any group, whether you're going to make it subject to the Administrative Procedure Act and require a formal, lengthy process in which an administrative law judge conducts a hearing and evaluates the legality and the need for and reasonableness of the rules before the agency can proceed with it, or whether you want the group to proceed like a nonprofit corporation, which has more power to do that, those kind of procedures and rules on its own. I've also listed here some other operating functions of government agencies. There's laws that govern purchase of goods and services, information technology, and significantly budgeting and accounting. Whether if you're a state agency and the money comes into the state treasury, it requires a legislative appropriation to take the money out of the state treasury. If you're a nonprofit group and the money is not in the state treasury, then it does not require a legislative act and a signature of the governor to take the money out of the state treasury. Audits. The legislative auditor has jurisdiction over all state agencies. The legislative auditor also has jurisdiction to audit, to follow the trail of public money, even when it's given to a nonprofit corporation. So those kind of protections are going to be there to some extent, regardless of the structure you choose, if public money is involved. Legal services. As you know, the Attorney General provides legal services to state agencies. And at least to some extent, this has a constitutional basis. So if you create a group as a state agency, you'd be limited in the extent to which you could provide for somebody else other than the Attorney General to provide legal services. If it were a nonprofit group, they would hire their own legal counsel. Interestingly, there's a provision that allows the executive branch to shift duties and powers among state agencies without legislative approval, either before or after. And this reorganization authority would allow the Commissioner of Administration to shift certain duties among state agencies. There are some limits on this ability, but it's an interesting power that applies that you might want to be aware of when thinking about the powers that are assigned to the exchange. Briefly, laws that govern executive branch agency employees. This state agency employees are hired through the state civil service system. In recent years, that has evolved to be a system that is somewhat more like private sector hiring. It is a resume-based system in which agencies look for essential skills and qualifications by scanning resumes and then select people to interview. It's not as much determined by the old concept of written civil service exams. But once a person is hired into the classified civil service, they can be discharged only for just cause, which is something that would not apply to an employee of a nonprofit corporation. Also, most state employees are represented by unions, and the terms and conditions of their employment are negotiated and contained in collective bargaining agreements. State employees also have health insurance and retirement coverage provided through public plans. At the end of the memo, I won't go through this, but I've just listed for your information. This is just examples. It's not comprehensive. A list of groups that are different from traditional executive branch state agencies, but most of which are created by law. MCHA, the Minnesota Zoo, a couple of economic development groups, Enterprise Minnesota Incorporated, Minnesota Business Finance Incorporated, Explore Minnesota Tourism, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. These are all groups that are created by law. The Gopher State One Call System, which some of you may be aware of, where group operators of underground lines are required by law to participate in a nonprofit corporation. This is one that where the corporation is not created by law, but its existence is mandated by law. Finally, I've given some examples of different, some other state government boards. These are all boards that are somewhat within state government, but that have some degree of independence from the governor. The Board on Aging. The Board on Aging is appointed by the governor, but the members serve staggered terms that overlap the governor, and members can be removed only for cause. The major pension boards, I've described the Minnesota State Retirement System here, which has a mixture of appointing authorities and a number of different specifications saying that some state laws do apply to it, some laws governing state agencies don't apply to it. And one interesting feature of the Minnesota State Retirement System and the other pension laws is that almost all of the major policy decisions governing these systems are made in law. So there's not a lot of rulemaking left to be done by these pension systems, which is different from some agencies like the Department of Human Services, where a lot of their policy is set in rule. For the pensions, there's a huge pension bill every year where all the pension policy is discussed at the legislature, not generally made by the Minnesota State Retirement System Board. And finally, I've noted the councils of color, the Council on Affairs of Chicano Latino People, Council on Black Minnesotans, Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Indian Affairs Council, where the voting members of the first three of these groups are appointed by the governor, but again, they have staggered terms, and they can be removed during these terms only for cause. So these groups are perceived as somewhat more independent than agencies that are under the direct control of the governor. With that, Madam Chair, I'd close my presentation, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? I don't think so. Thank you very much for your very good work. So, members, we are going to be sending out to you this week some draft recommendations, which you may look at and decide if you agree with them or not, and or if you think they're complete enough, and or if you think there need to be additions made. It's just kind of a working document, a place to start for people to look at, and we will be discussing those recommendations to the full Healthcare Access Commission at our next meeting. And if you have any comments or any large suggestions that you'd like to send in ahead of time so that they could be incorporated into the document, please feel free to do that. Any other questions or anything else today? If not, that does complete our agenda, and the meeting is adjourned. Schedule set for the whole year.